Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now endeavoring to take up the book of 1 Kings. Our context is this, because 1 Kings is a continuation of 2 Samuel. At the end of 2 Samuel, we saw some summary events, a capitulation, if you will, of the last days of David and some salient events in his reign. And now we're going to see him in 1 Kings dying as the kingdom is transferred to Solomon. It was not a smooth transition, as we will see. Before we take up the story, let's look at some introductory material on the book of Kings. Remember, 1 and 2 Kings originally was one book. As far as the date, this is according to Wikipedia. Quote, the authorship, or rather compilation, of these books is uncertain. The date of its composition was perhaps sometime between 561 B.C., the date of the last chapter, 2 Kings 25, when Jehoiachin was released from captivity by evil Merodach, and 538 B.C., the date of the decree of deliverance by Cyrus the Great. Now, those two dates are solid. We're getting, as we go more recently into the chronology of the Old Testament, we're getting into an area where dates are a lot more certain. And that date, 561 to 538 B.C., jives with what gotquestions.org says. They say the book was written between 560 and 540, which sounds like a round-off to me. So we're talking about a clear date after the story of the kings was over. Now, Wikipedia mentions, of course, that it's a compilation because a lot of state records were used by whoever the author was. Well, who was the author? Wikipedia says this, there are some portions that are almost identical to the book of Jeremiah. And then Wikipedia cites several sections that are identical. There are many undesigned coincidences between Jeremiah and Kings. Again, more citations of Scripture. And events recorded in Kings of which Jeremiah had personal knowledge. Because of this, traditionally, Jeremiah was credited the author of the books of Kings. GotQuestions.org says this, quote, the tradition is that it was written by the prophet Jeremiah. That's good enough for me. So we're going to say Jeremiah wrote the book of Kings, even though it doesn't say that he wrote the book of Kings. But it seems rather a strong tradition to me. Now, even though we grant that Jeremiah wrote the book, we need to realize more, as Wikipedia goes on to say, the books plainly acknowledge several source texts in several places, and it is hence self-evidently a compilation from earlier sources rather than an original work. A superficial examination of the books of Kings makes clear the fact that they are a compilation and not an original composition. In the case of Solomon, it is the book of the Acts of Solomon, 1 Kings 11:41. For the northern kingdom, it is the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel, which is cited 17 times. And for the kings of Judah, it is the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah, which is cited 15 times. As well as the text's own admission, the idea of the text being composed from multiple earlier sources is also supported by textual criticism. Whether the editor had access to these chronicles as they were deposited in the state archives, or simply access to a history based upon them, cannot with certainty be determined, though it is generally assumed that the latter was the case. Well, that's just saying that the author, if it were Jeremiah, he had access to chronicles that were written locally for Solomon's kingdom, for the northern kingdom of Israel, for the southern kingdom of Judah. Well, so what? I mean, everybody, all historians do that. Now, one more interesting detail from Wikipedia. As early supposition was that Ezra, after the Babylonian captivity, compiled them from official court chronicles of David, Solomon, Nathan, Gad, and Iddo, compiled the two books of Kings, and that he arranged them in the order in which they now exist. That was an earlier supposition. However, it is more usually said that Ezra was the compiler of the books of Chronicles, not Kings, an alternate history of the period of the kings, which was earlier in history treated as a single book, together with the book of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah. Okay, well, we're not going to do Chronicles, because Chronicles so closely parallels 1 Kings and 2 Kings in Pretty Good Bible Studies. But what we're going to do is look into the book of Chronicles in parallel passages when we need to pick up some extra details. We'll assume here that Wikipedia is right, that Ezra compiled Chronicles. So let's begin now in 1 Kings chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. When King David was old and well advanced in years, he could not keep warm even when they put covers over him. So his servants said to him, "Let us look for a young virgin to attend the king and take care of him. She can lie beside him so that our lord the king may keep warm." Then they searched throughout Israel for a beautiful girl, and found Abishag, a Shunammite, and brought her to the king. The girl was very beautiful. She took care of the king and waited on him. but the king had no intimate relations with her. Now, David was old. He was 70 years old or so, Gill says. Clark says 69. Let's just say 70. He was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. That's stated in 2 Samuel 5:4. That's how we can tie his age down so well. Now, the date of this story that we're about to relate is 970 B.C. That's according to BibleHub.com timeline and also according to Wikipedia, so the dates are getting relatively clear now. 1010 is when David began to rule the joint kingdom of Israel, and 970 is when he died for an even 40 years. Now, in verse 1, it is stated that David could not keep warm. Now, you would think that he would be healthy at 70, but remember, David had had many wars that he fought in. Think of how tough that is on somebody. Fatigues by night and by day. How about all the sorrows and afflictions he met with from his family and his friends? He had a son assassinated. He had a daughter raped. He had another son killed in a battle, a civil war, in fact, which was waged against him. Adam Clark says, quote, "He seems to have labored under some wasting maladies to which there is frequent reference in the Psalms." So David's not doing so good at the age of 70. Now, this idea of putting a virgin in bed with him is an interesting idea, to say the least. I am now exactly at 70 years old, so I sort of identify with David. I'm not quite as banged up as he is. I've never taken part in wars. I don't know what my wife would think about getting a virgin to keep me warm at night if I promised that there would be no hanky-panky going on. But it doesn't seem to be a problem back then. As Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown say, this was a common medical practice in the East to put girls in the beds of old men who couldn't keep warm. Now, his servants did that. It's probably his physicians, as is often speculated, that came up with this idea. Now, why does she need to be a virgin? Well, I love John Gill's reason. This is what he says. A virgin, quote, "has more natural heat than women that have bore children have, which is abated thereby." In other words, you have a child, all your heat leaves you, and so therefore you can't keep an old man warm. Now, that's rich. I suspect another reason is if she's not a virgin, that means she's probably married to somebody, and the husband would probably not appreciate his wife trying to keep another man warm. I don't know. She could be a divorcee without a husband to object, but for some reason they had to have a virgin. Well, let's look at this problem. Of course, it's a problem that none of my commentators discuss, so these are all my speculations, which are off the wall. Take them or leave them. Why was it necessary to have a virgin to keep David warm? Well, let's assume it was a married non-virgin. Well, the husband would probably object to that. Well, what about a divorcee or a widow who was not a virgin? Why not use somebody like that? This is my speculation. A virgin could be checked to see if she were still a virgin after her duties were over, thus maintaining her reputation. Can't do that with a non-virgin. When I say checked, I mean medically checked, as people seem to be able to do. I don't know. It's interesting speculation, but at any rate, she was a virgin. Now, the next question is, was she David's wife? Now, Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown say that she was David's wife, a concubine. Pulpit commentary denies that. So let's look at that issue. The older expositors assume that the girl was David's wife on the theory that it would be unthinkable to bring a young girl into the king's bed without marriage, or at least making her a concubine. Another point in favor of this assertion that the girl was David's wife is that Adonijah really wanted to marry Abishag, as we'll see later, 1 Kings 2:17, "Please speak to King Solomon, since he won't turn you down. Let him give me Abishag the Shunammite as a wife." That's Adonijah speaking, asking someone to give him Abishag. Abishag was a desired object, and Adonijah really wanted to marry Abishag, as we'll see later, and it would make more sense that he would really want Abigail as a wife, because she would be the king's wife, David's wife, and that would signify a transfer of power from David to Adonijah. Okay, well, that sounds pretty good, but let's look at the other side, the other argument, that she was not David's wife. Benson, the commentator, holds that view. The pulpit commentator says, no, she was not David's wife. She was an unmarried virgin. Well, here's some arguments that she was not David's wife. A marriage needs consummation, and that was not present here. This is my idea. How could she be said to be married if the marriage was never consummated? The pulpit commentary also says it won't do just to say that the law allows polygamy. A lot of people who say that this was Abigail was David's wife, they say, well, the law allows polygamy, no problem. Well, that doesn't prove anything. Just because the law allows polygamy doesn't mean that Abigail was a wife. That's a dumb argument. So I fall down on the position that this was a young unmarried virgin. Now, the next question is was this immoral? Well, no, it wasn't. First of all, the Jewish law allowed polygamy, and even if she was married to David and they would have had sex, then it would have been legal in that situation. So he could never be accused of adultery, whether he had sex with her or not. But the text plainly says he never had sex with her. Well, if he never has sex with her, how is that immoral? So the next question that arises is, well, why is this detail even mentioned? Option number one, to show that David was chaste. Well, Gil denies that. And again, if she was married to David, you would need to show David is chaste. So I don't think that's correct. John Gill says that the reason is to show that David is so weak, he's lost the desire for women. I think others say that too, but Colin Delitzsch deny that. Colin Delitzsch and the Cambridge commentary say the reason that this virgin is mentioned, or the reason that Abigail's virginity is mentioned, is to show why Adonijah would still want her for a wife. Because if she had had sex with David, of course, she would be off limits to Adonijah. It would be incest then. So I think that's the reason that the virgin detail is mentioned here. Now, one more point. In verse 3, Abigail the Shunammite was said to be a beautiful virgin. And John Gill says, David would not have suffered an ugly virgin to lie next to him. Well, of course not. He's the king. He's got to have beautiful virgins. Now, in verse 4, the fact is mentioned that David had not had any intimate relations with Abishag the Shunammite. Why mention that? Well, again, it could be to show David's chastity, but I don't think that's so. It could be to show that David was feeble. He couldn't have intimate relations. But as mentioned earlier, the reason that it was mentioned that he had no intimate relations with Abishag is to reaffirm the fact that Abishag was a virgin, and so that would make sense for Adonijah to request her as a wife later on in the narrative. Now, Abishag is said to be from Shunem. She's a Shunammite. Shunem is right at the foot of Mount Moriah to the western side. Mount Moriah, you recall from the story of Gideon. This is in the valley of Esdraelon, or the valley of Jezreel. The spring of Harod is about 5 miles to the south and east a little bit. That was Gideon's stomping grounds. Jezreel was where the last battle with King Saul and the Philistines took place. It's about maybe 10 miles to the northwest up the valley of Jezreel from Bethshan, where Saul and Jonathan had their corpses nailed up on the wall after the battle of Jezreel. So this is about maybe 6 or 7 miles on the other side of Mount Moreh, M-O-R-E-H, where Endor is. That's where the famous Witch of Endor was, that Saul called up right there, right before his last battle. So these are well-known places. Shunem is actually about 8 or 9 miles to the southwest of Mount Tabor, which, of course, is mentioned in the Gospels. And by the way, some people think that Abishag the Shunammite is the same as the Shulamite woman mentioned in the Song of Solomon because of the similarity of the names. I don't believe that for a minute, but I thought I would just mention that as an incidental detail. We go down to 1 Kings chapter 1, verses 5 and 6. Now, Adonijah, whose mother was Haggith, put himself forward and said, I will be king. So he got chariots and horses ready, and with 50 men to run ahead of him. His father had never interfered with him by asking, why do you behave as you do? He was also very handsome, not his father, talking about Adonijah, was also very handsome and was born next after Absalom. Absalom being dead, that means Adonijah is probably the heir presumptive because he's the next in line according to age. Now, he got 50 men to run ahead of his chariots. This seems to be a standard practice to show that I'm the big shot and king here. Absalom did it. It's to make yourself respectable. 2 Samuel 15:1. Now, it came about after this that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. So that's what you did when you wanted to proclaim yourself king. Now, if David even knew about this, he never interfered, it says in verse 6, but doesn't say whether he knew or not. But if he did know about it, he probably figured Adonijah's just acting as the presumptive heir to the throne, so he didn't do anything. And especially if he knew about it, by his not doing anything to stop it, that would make everybody who saw this think that David is consenting that Adonijah be the next king. and Adonijah probably believed that David had consented also. Of course, later on, we're going to see that Bathsheba's going to say, now, wait a minute, David, what are you doing here? So if he did know and didn't stop it, that means he was planning to pass the kingdom on to Adonijah and then later changed his mind when Bathsheba and Nathan come into him and say, no, you promised that Solomon would be king, not Adonijah. Some people have said the fact that David had never interfered with Adonijah shows that he's weak, guilty of the same laxity as Eli was with his sons Hophni and Phinehas. Adonijah probably thought David was old and weak and he wouldn't interfere in his revolt. And of course, it could be that Adonijah was doing this chariot business with the 50 men running ahead in such a way that David wouldn't know. But I don't know how David could not know. I mean, he's the king. He's in a palace. It seems like he would know that what's going on in Jerusalem. Somebody would tell him. I'm going to assume he knew. But he figured, well, okay, we'll just let it go. He's getting ready to be king. It's not really a revolt. He's next in line. He must have forgotten about his promise to Bathsheba that Solomon would be king. Now, Adonijah in verse 6 is said to be born next to Absalom. Well, Amnon is dead because Absalom killed him when Amnon raped Absalom's sister Tamar. So Amnon's gone. Kileab is not mentioned anywhere, so the scholars assume he's already dead. And, of course, Absalom died in the civil war against King David when he got his head caught in a tree and Joab killed him. And so Adonijah is the eldest son living. His mother was Haggith. That's a different mother than Absalom's mother, who was Maacah from Geshur, east of the Sea of Galilee. Haggith is otherwise unknown. We go now to 1 Kings 1, verses 7 through 8. Adonijah conferred with Joab, son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar, the priest, and they gave him their support. But Zadok the priest, Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shimei and Rei, and David's special guard did not join Adonijah. Now Joab, of course, is the famous Joab. David had a sister named Zeruiah, and Zeruiah had a son named Joab and another son named Abishai and another son named Asahel. Abishai and Joab were the surviving sons that fought together in David's kingdom. Joab was still commander-in-chief. He got demoted one time, but he pushed his way back to the top. David hated Joab, but Joab was one mean general. He won just about every time he fought. Adonijah needed his military strength, and he got him. Now, once again, Joab is screwing up things with David, because David's eventually going to want Solomon in charge, but Joab is gone with Adonijah. Now, there are three reasons that David might hate Joab. First of all, Joab had murdered Abner, who was the northern kingdom of Israel's, Saul's descendants, the northern kingdom of Israel's general, and David had just made peace with Abner, getting ready to reunite the kingdom after his 7-year rule at Hebron, and then Joab, in a fit of personal revenge, murdered Abner, because Abner had killed Joab's brother Asahel earlier, not through any fault of Abner. So Joab did some really bad things there and screwed up David's peace plans. And then when David had appointed Amasa as king because Joab had offended him, because Joab had criticized David for being such a crybaby when Absalom died, and Joab was very insolent. So David just said, okay, you're not going to be general anymore, Joab. We're going to put Amasa, who's your first cousin by another wife, another sister of David besides Zeruiah. I'm going to put Amasa in charge. And Joab sinks back. But then later on, by stealth, he stabbed Amasa in the gut and killed him. And then, of course, Joab had killed his son Absalom against David's expressed orders as Absalom was hanging in the tree. And Joab was generally insolent toward David. David hated his guts, but he needed him because of his military power. Well, Joab is gone with Adonijah. Now, Abiathar the priest. Now, that must have hurt, too, because Abiathar had left with David. He was the lone survivor of Saul's massacre of the priest of Nob, right there north of the Mount of Olives. And David had gone there to get bread with his band of rebels, or I should say fugitives, not rebels, against King Solomon. Then he headed for the wilderness. Abiathar went with David and was with him all through his kingdom. David lost him. He goes with Adonijah. So now Adonijah's got a military supporter and he's got a priestly supporter. That's pretty strong. Abiathar must have seen plainly that the priesthood, which was in Eli's family, Ithamar, was declining. And of course, Abiathar is in that family of Ithamar, Ithamar being the fourth son of Aaron, the high priest. And Zadok was probably going to eclipse him, Abiathar's thought, so he goes with Adonijah to try to get his power back, hoping Adonijah would win. Zadok stayed behind with David, did not join Adonijah. Zadok is of the family of Eleazar, Aaron's third son, and that family had taken over when Eli had screwed up, and somewhere between Eli and Saul, Zadok, the family of Eleazar had taken over, and then during the time of Saul, Zadok of that family of Eleazar was appointed as high priest in the kingdom. So when David joined Hebron and Israel together as one kingdom, he just kept two high priests for political reasons. He had Abiathar and he had Zadok, two high priests at the same time. And so Abiathar must have looked at Zadok, realized that Zadok was now a favored priest. This is speculation, I guess, but Abiathar is the favorite priest of David, and David is going to, when Solomon is chosen, David is going to make Zadok the high priest, and Abiathar is going to be the odd man out, so he goes to Adonijah. Nothing like mixing political ambitions with your religious duties. Now, Benaiah stayed with David and Solomon. He's the one who is in charge over David's bodyguards. The special guard, as the NIV has it, those are the Cherethites and Pelethites. I've already mentioned them. There's about 9 different speculations as to who these guys were, but they were a special military unit, and Benaiah was, quote, distinguished for his bravery, as one of my commentators said. He had been appointed captain of the king's bodyguard and was regarded by Joab as a rival. That makes sense. So we got military and religious leaders on Adonijah's side, and we got military and religious leaders now on Solomon's side. And speaking of religious leaders, there's Nathan the prophet, David's famous prophet that prophesied the kingdom of the Messiah is going to last forever. Shimei is also remaining with David and not going with Adonijah. Now, who is the Shimei? He could have been the one who cursed David as David was leaving during Absalom's civil war, as he was walking up the Mount of Olives and went all the way up to Bahurim on the other side of the peak of the Mount of Olives. And then Shimei comes and throws dust on him and rocks, curses him. I think he called him a murderer, if I remember correctly. Well, Shimei might, after David had pardoned him, after the civil war was over, Shimei might have figured, I think I'm going to stay with David. He's pardoned my life. I'm not going to rebel again. Some people say that this Shimei might be a different Shimei, one of Solomon's 12 officers mentioned in 1 Kings 4:18. We don't know. Somebody named Rei stays with David. Some options that have been suggested, Hushai the Archite, David's friend who insinuated himself into Absalom's council and gave Absalom some bad advice so that David could win that civil war. Some people, he's the same as a priest named Ira mentioned in 2 Samuel 20, verse 26. He's minor, we don't know. And the special guard, the Cherethites and the Pelethites, they stay with David. So David still got a lot of people on his side, but it's still a serious rebellion, too. This is serious business. Remember, Nathan had prophesied to David, the sword's never going to leave your house because of what you did with Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite, committing adultery and murder. Well, even on his deathbed, he's got the sword in his house. We go now to 1 Kings chapter 1, verses 9 and 10. Adonijah then sacrificed sheep, cattle, and fattened calves at the stone of Zoheleth near Enrogel. He invited all his brothers, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah who were royal officials. But he did not invite Nathan the prophet, or Benaiah, or the special guard, the Cherethites and the Pelethites, or his brother Solomon. Now, Adam Clark speculates that the sheep that were sacrificed were probably offered as a sacrifice first and then eaten as a feast, which seemed more like a kingly thing. Ooh, we got a big feast. It's an inauguration feast, a coronation feast. I'm king now. The stone of Zoheleth, Easton's dictionary says that this is the serpent stone. And it means, that's what the Hebrew means, a serpent stone, a rocky plateau near the center of the village of Siloam and near the fountain of Enrogel. Now, Enrogel is right to the south of the city of David, Mount Zion, right where the Kidron Valley intersects the Tarpeian Valley and the Valley of Hinnom on the south. Easton goes on to say that Enrogel is where the women of the village resorted for water, and that the stone of Zoheleth projects into or slightly overhangs the Kidron Valley. And he says it is now still can be identified by a rock there that's got a name, two names which I'm not going to mention. Easton also says, or somebody says, I don't have the site here, that some dictionary says that the women laid clothes upon the stone of Zoheleth for the water to drain out of them. Zoheleth signifying a slow motion of waters on which they beat the clothes to get out the spots. Well, that's nice. But anyway, it was a place where was well known, is not too far from Jerusalem. It's right to the south of Mount Zion, the city of David. John Gill says, En Rogel means the Fuller's Fountain. It's near the King's Gardens. The King's Gardens were inside the wall on the southern end of the city of David. James Fawcett Brown says, En Rogel is the Fountain of the Treaders, i.e. the Foot Fountain, also called the Fuller's Fountain, because fullers here trod the clothes in water. It's been identified in a modern site. I take that with a grain of salt because they don't know exactly where it is. Jamin Fawcett and Brown says it is a very deep well measuring 125 feet in depth. The water is sweet but not very cold and is at times quite full to overflowing. Well, he's pretty sure they found it, but wherever it was close by, close enough for a revolution to go on. Adonijah asked all of his brothers, that would be all the sons of David by David's wives and concubines. He had a lot of them. They were all younger than Adonijah, and so they weren't going to pretend to the throne, so Adonijah doesn't mind asking them. In fact, they were going to support him. Now, some of these other sons, it has been speculated, might not like Solomon being appointed. After all, he was the product of adultery. So maybe Adonijah figured, I've got to beat out Solomon. Assuming that Adonijah knows that the kingdom had been promised to Solomon, and that's a problem we're going to see in just a minute, but I'm going to assume that for right now, if Adonijah knew that Solomon had been appointed by David, well, the other brothers might not like Solomon being appointed as king because Solomon was really sort of an illegitimate king. He was legitimized by David's later birth, but what David did was pretty terrible. Solomon's birth was tainted, in other words. Now, Adonijah did not invite Nathan to his insurrectionary feast, a speculation as to why, because Nathan had arguably prophesied of Solomon's succession to the throne. 2 Samuel 7:12, Nathan tells David, when your time comes and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up after you your descendant who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. Well, Nathan doesn't mention Solomon by name, and many scholars say that when Nathan says, I will raise up after you your descendant, Nathan is meaning here that there is an unborn son of David that will be raised up. That's why Nathan didn't name a particular son, because the son had not been born yet. Well, if so, that means David would be referring to Solomon, and all of Solomon's and Adonijah's brothers would know, the younger brothers would know, that Solomon is really who has been prophesied to be king, and they don't like Solomon, so they want to go with Adonijah. We go now to 1 Kings 1, verses 11 through 14. Then Nathan asked Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king without our Lord David's knowing it? Now then, let me advise you how you can save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Go in to David and say to him, my lord the king, did you not swear to me your servant? Surely Solomon your son shall be king after me, and he will sit on my throne. Why then has Adonijah become king? While you are still there talking to the king, I, referring to Nathan, I will come in and confirm what you, Bathsheba, hath said. Now Nathan tells Bathsheba that Adonijah has already become king. In other words, Adonijah is now considered as being legally appointed to the regal office, and no doubt was about to begin to perform its functions, as Adam Clark says. He's king. He has become king. That's bad business. And it happened without our Lord David's knowing it. Now, David may have known of Adonijah's preparations, as I said earlier. He might have seen the chariot with the 50 runners and thinking, well, he's just practicing for when he takes over. But I think it's clear that it's obviously clear that David didn't know that Adonijah had been proclaimed king because Nathan says so right here. And I'm sure Nathan would know that. David was not aware of all the festivities down there at the Rock of Zoeleth near En Rogel, at the south of Jerusalem. Now, Nathan tells Bathsheba, I know how you can save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Was Nathan being a little histrionic there? No, he wasn't, because if you got a political revolution and civil war, the winners in these ancient societies killed any claimants to the throne. So Bathsheba's and Solomon's lives were definitely at stake here. So this is serious business. Now, Nathan urges Bathsheba in verse 13 to go in to David and say, don't you remember that oath you made to me? My lord the king, did you not swear to me, your servant? Surely Solomon, your son, Bathsheba's son, shall be king after me, and he will sit on my throne, that Solomon will sit on David's throne. Didn't he say that? Well, that's nowhere recorded, and so some folks have speculated that Nathan is making this up. This is a plot, a trick to fool David into switching his support from Adonijah to Solomon. Well, I read a couple of articles on that, and I don't believe that for a minute. Just because there was no mention made of an oath that David made to Bathsheba that Solomon would be on the throne, although I got some verses that might actually prove that David made that promise to Solomon, but let's just say you can make an argument that no scriptures are there. Well, so what? It's an argument from silence. There was an oath made from David to Bathsheba, and Nathan had knowledge of that oath. He either knew it from David, or he knew it from Bathsheba, or he knew it from both David and Bathsheba. Maybe he was even present when the oath was made. Now, let's look at two scriptures that back up this idea that there was an actual oath from David to Bathsheba that Solomon would inherit the kingdom. 2 Samuel 7:12. This is Nathan speaking to David. When your time comes and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up after you your descendant, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. Now, that's verse, of course, is not directed directly at Bathsheba. It was Nathan speaking to David, and it was not precise as who the descendant will be. So, okay, we can say that doesn't really prove that there was an oath between David and Bathsheba. But how about this in 1 Chronicles 22:9? This is Yahweh speaking to David, and God says this, "But a son will be born to you, David. He will be a man of rest. I will give him rest from all his surrounding enemies, for his name will be Solomon. And I will give peace and quiet to Israel during his reign." Now, that's precise as to who the descendant will be. Now, those two verses don't say that an oath was made from David to Bathsheba that Solomon would be put on the throne. That is true. But here's some proof that there was an oath. First of all, Bathsheba herself affirms it. In 1 Kings 1:17, she says, "My Lord, you swore to your servant by the Lord your God, your son Solomon is to become king after me, and he is the one who is to sit on my throne." Well, of course, you could say Bathsheba was lying, and I guess some people do, but I would take her at her word that it just sounds to me like David has actually spoken that promise to her. Also, we read in 1 Kings 1:30 that David owns that oath and confirms it. 1 Kings 1:30. "Just as I, David, swore to you, Bathsheba, by the Lord God of Israel, your son Solomon is to become king after me, and he is the one who is to sit on my throne in my place. That is exactly what I will do this very day." So David swears that he had already told Bathsheba that Solomon was coming after. Was he wrong? Was he addled? Was he lying? I don't think so. Now, there are still those who say that Nathan and Bathsheba fabricated this oath. I found an interesting article from the Journal of Evangelical Theological Society by a gentleman named Newkirk, who lists all the arguments pro and con on this issue. Newkirk comes down strong on the assertion that David's oath to Bathsheba was real. It was not fabricated by Bathsheba and Nathan. Now, Newkirk mentions two primary arguments that are used to say that David never made an oath to Bathsheba. First of all, 2 Samuel doesn't record the oath. Well, that doesn't mean a thing. That's a weak argument from silence. The arguments from silence are usually very weak, unless the silence is deafening, and it's not deafening there. Second argument that those who say this is a fake oath, manufactured and fabricated by Nathan and Bathsheba, is this. The second argument is this. David is senile and easily manipulated, and so they suckered him, Bathsheba and Nathan did. Well, the quick answer to that is David was not senile. He was weak. He needed a virgin to keep him warm at night, but that doesn't mean he was senile. How do we know? Well, David gave specific directions for how Solomon should be crowned in this very chapter, which we'll get to in just a minute, verses 28 through 35. On his deathbed, he gave deathbed instructions to Solomon, which were quoted directly out of Deuteronomy in the next chapter, 1 Kings 2, verses 2 through 4. So we're going to go with the idea that this was a sincere promise that David made to Bathsheba, and Bathsheba is reminding him of it in this hour of necessity. Now, what would the public think about the succession? Well, first of all, David's private promise to Bathsheba was private. The public did not know about it, at least not that we know about. And Adonijah was the oldest son, and so they probably thought, yeah, Adonijah's going to be the one, and David's not complaining. Adonijah's out here running his chariot around with his 50 runners. He's having a big festival down there at En-Rogel, at the Rock of Zoelith. So David must not care, so Adonijah's going to be the one. Now, that's the natural inclination of people, but God has never said that the oldest son is the one who inherits. David was not the oldest son of Saul. He didn't inherit. Ishbosheth didn't keep the kingdom. He was the oldest surviving son of Saul. David took it. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says about the succession question. Quote, "Hitherto the succession of the Hebrew monarchy had not been settled. The Lord had reserved to himself the right of nomination." This is in Deuteronomy 7:15, which reads this, "You are to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses," not the oldest son. "Appoint a king from your brothers. You are not to set a foreigner over you or one who is not of your people." So God chooses. And the right of that divine right of nomination was acted upon in the appointments both of Saul and David. God chose them both. And in the case of the latter, in the case of David, the rule was so far modified that his posterity were guaranteed the perpetual possession of the sovereignty. His posterity still doesn't say the oldest kid, though. James and Fawcett and Brown continue and say this divine purpose was known throughout the kingdom, but no intimation had been made as to whether the right of inheritance was to belong to the oldest son. So God never said the oldest son. David never said the oldest son being Adonijah. But the people would probably assume that because that's generally the way people think. The oldest son inherits, at least in the ancient world. Now, there's lots of exceptions to that. The Saxon kings in early English history didn't take the monarchy by right of inheritance of the oldest son. There was a council, the Witan, I guess is how you say that. The council elected a king. And there's lots of exceptions to the oldest son taking over. And look at in the Roman Empire, lots of times it was a general that took over. So Bathsheba asked David, "Why has Adonijah become king, given your promise to me?" And again, as I say, Adonijah would expect the natural arrangement should follow, as in all other situations. In most other situations in the ancient world, Adonijah is the oldest son. The rest of the people would generally think so too, but not Bathsheba. She said, "I had a promise from you, David." Well, she hadn't done this yet. This is just Nathan advising her what to say when she goes in, and she's supposed to go into David and remind him of this promise that he had made to her that Solomon would sit on the throne. And then in verse 14, Nathan says, "While you, Bathsheba, are still there talking to the king, talking to David, I will come in and confirm what you have said." And he's going to do that. Jargil says that Nathan will make up what might be wanting in her address to David in Bathsheba's account of things or in the arguments used by her. In other words, if she doesn't persuade David, Nathan's going to come in and back her up, put a full court press on him. We go now to 1 Kings 1, verses 15 through 21. "So Bathsheba went to see the aged king in his room, where Abishag the Shunammite was attending him. Bathsheba bowed low and knelt before the king. 'What is it you want?' the king asked. She said to him, 'My lord, you yourself swore to me, your servant, by the Lord your God, Solomon your son shall be king after me, and he will sit on my throne. But now Adonijah has become king, and you, my lord the king, do not know about it. He has sacrificed great numbers of cattle, fattened calves and sheep, and has invited all the king's sons, Abiathar the priest and Joab the commander of the army, but he has not invited Solomon your servant. My lord the king, the eyes of all Israel are on you, to learn from you who will sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. Otherwise, as soon as my lord the king is laid to rest with his fathers, I and my son Solomon will be treated as criminals.'" Notice how many times Bathsheba calls David my lord the king. She's being very, very submissive here, very polite. Now that swearing that Bathsheba is mentioning too, that David had done, is mentioned down in verse 30. "Just as I," talking about David, "just as I, David, swore to you, Bathsheba, by the Lord God of Israel, your son Solomon is to become king after me." So we assume that there was a previous, very true, non-fabricated oath between David and Bathsheba that Solomon was going to sit on the throne. Going back to Bathsheba's speech to David, she said, "My lord, David, you yourself swore by the Lord, by Yahweh." And that's a very solemn oath. That's not a vain oath. You swear by Yahweh. And Bathsheba knew David was pious enough to take such oaths seriously. I wonder whether he just forgot. Now, in verse 18, she softens her implicit criticisms of King David because she says, you know, Adonijah's king, but you, David, didn't know about it. I'm telling you now, but I'm sure that it's because you didn't know about it, you haven't put Solomon on the throne, or you haven't stopped him. If you knew about it, you would stop him. So she's being very gentle here. She doesn't want David to think that Bathsheba is blaming David for breaking his oath. John Gill says, concerning this action of Adonijah secretly becoming king without David knowing it, quote, "The sin of Adonijah is the more heinous, that he should do this without consulting his father about it, and was not only neglect of him as a father and an act of disrespect and disobedience to him as such, but even of high treason to assume the throne in his father's lifetime without his consent." And so Bathsheba continues speaking to David. She says, "David, Adonijah has sacrificed great numbers of cattle, fattened calves, and sheep. So Adonijah is partying while you, David, are dying." John Gill says that Adonijah was, quote, "showing all the tokens of pleasure in the view of David's death and wishing for it." I'm sure he was wishing for David to die. And Bathsheba continues, "Adonijah has not invited Solomon," which shows this is not an ordinary celebration. This is a political gathering because Solomon was not invited, Solomon being next in line to the throne after Adonijah. Bathsheba continues in verse 20, and she says, "All the eyes of Israel, the eyes of all Israel, on you to learn who's going to be sitting on the throne after you die." Bathsheba wants David to know that the people are not yet behind Adonijah. Everybody's looking. Adonijah's down here. He's making a claim, but people are still wavering, going back and forth. They want to know what you think. David, you're the king now. Who do you want to take over? Who do you want to succeed you? Now, as Adam Clark says, this was a monarchy that was neither hereditary nor elective, as I've mentioned earlier. The king simply named his successor. Now, Clark says that this method of the king naming his successor is obtained more or less in ancient countries. Well, that's true, but usually the kings named their oldest son, but sometimes the oldest sons were deadbeats, and so they would name somebody else, and it would cause all kind of trouble, at least in medieval history. I assume it's the same in ancient history, too. Here's what Jameson, Foster, and Brown say about this. "When the kings died without declaring their will, then their oldest son succeeded. But frequently they designated long before their death which of their sons should inherit the throne." Same thing in the Middle Ages. Sometimes they'd appoint a king 10, 20 years before they died, and he became kind of like a junior king to get practice so he could just step into the monarchy when the old man died. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown continue, "The kings of Persia, as well as of other eastern countries, have exercised the same right in modern and even recent times." So I guess what we can take away from all that is Adonijah's being a little bit presumptive by saying, "Hey, I'm the oldest son, so I'm going to take over." Well, not necessarily. It would have been nice if you'd gotten your father David's permission or sanction. Bathsheba then points out the downside of Adonijah being elected king. She says, "I, Bathsheba, and my son Solomon will be treated as criminals." Well, she could be referring to the fact that she's an adulteress and Solomon, her son, was a bastard. Technically a bastard. Or she could have said, "We were criminals because we're pretenders to the throne, and guess what happens to the pretenders to the throne? We get killed. That's the custom in the East." So she's pleading with David for her life here. 1 Kings 1:22-27, and we'll finish this audio. "While she was still speaking with the king, Nathan the prophet arrived, and they told the king, 'Nathan the prophet is here.' So he went before the king and bowed with his face to the ground. Nathan said, 'Have you, my lord the king, declared that Adonijah shall be king after you, and that he will sit on your throne? Today he has gone down and sacrificed great numbers of cattle, fattened calves, and sheep. He has invited all the king's sons, the commanders of the army, and Abiathar the priest. Right now they are eating and drinking with him and saying, 'Long live King Adonijah!' But me, your servant, Nathan, and Zadok the priest, and Benaiah son of Jehoiada, and your servant Solomon he did not invite. Is this something my lord the king has done without letting his servants know who should sit on the throne of my lord the king after him?" Now when Nathan arrived, they told the king, "Nathan the prophet is here." David was feeble. He might not have known who had come into the room or if anyone had come into the room at all. So that's sort of a detail that rings true. David arrived there. John Gill speculates, quote, "Perhaps Nathan was at the chamber door all the while Bathsheba was speaking, and when he perceived she was just finishing, he entered in without ceremony, as he had used to do, being the king's seer and counselor and a prophet who had admittance to the king at any time." So Nathan goes in according to his prearranged plan. Remember in verse 14, Nathan had told Bathsheba, "At that moment, after you've talked to the king about this oath that he swore with you about Solomon, while you're telling him that," in verse 14 says, "While you, Bathsheba, are still there speaking with the king, I, Nathan, will come in after you and confirm your words." And that's what's happening here. Nathan adds a detail here. He says the commanders of the army are down there at En-Rogel at the Rock of Zoelith, feasting and carrying on. So it's not just Joab. When you got Joab and commanders of the army, you have got what looks like a serious attempt at a coup. So in verse 27, Nathan asked David, is there something you haven't told me yet? Have you decided to give the kingdom to Adonijah without telling me? If so, then that's the explanation of the feasting down there, and I'm not going to worry about it. Well, the question arises here, why would Nathan even ask David this question? Why not just tell David? Adonijah's trying to usurp the throne. Why does he give David a chance to perhaps explain that Adonijah is not usurping the throne? Well, here's some possibilities for that to answer that question. One, perhaps David had changed his mind. Maybe he originally wanted to put Solomon on the throne and changed his mind and gone back to Adonijah. John Gill also speculates maybe David had direction from the Lord to make a change. It wasn't his change, but it was God's change. Well, why did Nathan not just say, Adonijah's stealing the throne? Maybe Nathan is just being careful and polite. He doesn't want to make David look so weak that a conspiracy is developing right under his nose, and David has done nothing to stop it. That's what I think. That's my idea. He and Bathsheba are both being very, very careful about David's sensibilities as they're saying, David, your kingdom's being taken away from you. Your precious oaths in the Lord, your divine oaths are being violated. You're putting your wife, your beloved wife Bathsheba, and your son Solomon in danger of being executed. Maybe you better get busy, son. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished 1 Kings 1, verses 22 through 27. We are now prepared to go in our next audio to 1 Kings 1, starting with verse 28. We will go all the way to the end of the chapter, verse 53, and we will see Solomon anointed as king, the third king of Israel, actually the second king of United Israel. And of course, Solomon is a very famous guy. He's kind of like the George Washington of Israel, the Mustafa Kemal, if you're Turkish. He's the kind of the father of your country. He's the guy that wrote the Song of Solomons and the book of Ecclesiastes. He became the number one king in the ancient Near East during his reign. So we'll see that in our next audio. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.